Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Thank you, and be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'm Ann Walsh Bradley, and seated next to me is an empty chair, and that's the Chief Justice. She will not be participating in this case, but we're going to proceed with aplomb in her absence. I want to, first of all, welcome the Edgewood High School students who are here today with our Court with Class program. I'm going to ask if you would please stand so we can see all of you. Look at all of this group. How marvelous. Well, welcome. Thank you. And be seated. Of course, you know, as the court knows, that you are part of this national award-winning program, Court with Class, and we're delighted to have you here today. I want to introduce now the members of the court to you, since we've now been introduced to you initially. And on my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. As I indicated, on my left is this chair. Sometimes we call the justice that's next John Roberts, but today we're calling him N. Patrick Crooks. So if you want to introduce yourself. And then, of course, Justice Patience Rogensack. And finally, Justice Annette Ziegler on the very far left. With that by way of introduction, we are going to call our first case this morning, and that is Hip versus Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. And would you state the appearances, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm David Rice. I'm from the Attorney General's office, where I'm an Assistant Attorney General. My opposing counsel today is Colleen Ball, representing Adrian Hip. I've noticed that this is one of the cases of the month also, and such. I'm trying this morning to give maybe a little broader presentation than I might otherwise. I would note that my reply brief was filed only last Monday because of the tight scheduling in this case, and as of yesterday, it wasn't on the website. For those students who'd be listening in, I'm told that that reply brief will be posted shortly.
Thank you.
Your Honors, for about the past 9 years, have had the responsibility within the Attorney General's office to represent the court system, individual judges and justices. One of those responsibilities is to represent circuit court judges in proceedings like this, where someone seeks a supervisory writ in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals asks for a response from the circuit judge, and then I respond on behalf of the circuit judge. Of the cases that I have pending currently, 9 of them involve supervisory writs where the underlying proceeding is a John Doe proceeding. Last December, on the 26th of December, in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there was an article about John Doe proceedings and some of the current controversy. But what they said in that case that I found interesting is that John Doe proceedings are concentrated right now in 3 counties, Dodge County, Grant County, and Milwaukee County. And that's seems odd. You wouldn't be surprised by Milwaukee because it's the largest county, but why Grant and Dodge? Well, the reason is that those are 2 counties where there are major state prisons. And in Dodge County alone, they're averaging now about 30 John Doe petitions from inmates every year. One inmate, according to this news article, filed more than 20 John Doe complaints. Now, what is the John Doe statute? The John Doe statute dates way back to before Wisconsin became a state, when it was a territory. And the first statute was the territorial statute in 1839. And why was the statute enacted? Well, before there were John Doe statutes, the common law practice, if you believed you were a victim of a crime, was to go to a magistrate, and then the magistrate would issue a warrant for the arrest of the accused. And at that point, the magistrate could do it simply on a mere suspicion that a crime had been committed. And the magistrate was protected against liability. But this was a very unsafe practice because many arrests were made on groundless suspicion when the accused were actually innocent of the crime, and there was no testimony or anything against them. And as a result, people were charged with crimes unnecessarily. So when the John Doe statute was enacted, and it was enacted first in 1839, and it was drawn from either New York or, I believe, Massachusetts, and it's interesting how they did statutory construction back in those days. They said the Chief Justice had come from one of those states and had been involved in the drafting, so it must have been based on that state rather than the other. But in any event, the statute was enacted for two purposes. The first purpose was to protect persons accused of crime by providing a procedure where the magistrate would not issue a John Doe, or rather a criminal complaint or a warrant, until there had been testimony taken under oath and a proceeding before that magistrate. The second part of it was to give crime victims an opportunity to bring crimes forward to the magistrate. Certainly, the first case that came to the Wisconsin Supreme Court was in 1889. The law had been in effect for 50 years at that point. That's the case of State Extra Long versus Keyes. And Justice Orton wrote the opinion for the court. And one of the things I thought was interesting is just how legal writing was in those days compared to how we write today.
It was a lot shorter, wasn't it?
You write considerably shorter, Justice Crooks, than Justice Orton. Let me give you an example from this case.
I'm amazed.
He says, describing an incident on October 1st of 1889, Alonzo Kellogg, George H. Paul, Charles H. Maxson, and divers other persons whose names were unknown to the complainant on the 10th of October 1889 at the city of Madison in said county did unlawfully, wantonly, and riotously assemble in a violent and tumultuous manner and gathered together to disturb the peace, and on being so as aforesaid congregated in and upon one Riley did then and there, wantonly and riotously in a violent and tumultuous manner make an assault, and did then and there unlawfully, wantonly, and riotously in a violent and tumultuous manner beat, bruise, and wound, and ill-treat the said Riley, to the terror and disturbance of, and thereby then and there greatly terrifying, alarming, and disturbing many and all of the good and peaceable people there and for a great distance around inhabiting, passing, and being against the peace and contrary to the statute. And that wasn't even the end of the sentence.
I was going to say, is that all one sentence?
It is.
Yeah. Not all of it.
Mr. Rice, you're touching on something that, that I wanted to ask about. There really seem to be two distinct purposes when we look at the John Doe statute.
Correct.
One is the purpose of a prosecutor, a district attorney, or assistant district attorney bringing a matter before the John Doe judge and asking for a determination ultimately of probable cause and the issuance of a complaint. But the other purpose seems to be to keep the courthouse door open for individuals to also come in and to ask that there be criminal charges filed. Usually in situations where, for one reason or another, the district attorney doesn't wish to proceed with criminal charges. And my concern is, can we develop a rule that serves both purposes? The Court of Appeals seem to be very concerned, as you know, with keeping the courthouse door open. But is there some balance that can be developed here? Because the statute, as you know, and I'm asking you compound questions, I know that, but the statute talks about the discretion given to the John Doe judge also. And I'm trying to figure out, how do we balance all of these things, all of these purposes behind the John Doe statute?
Well, I think the best way to answer that question is to, again, consider a little bit of the history, and I will answer your question directly in that context. From 1839, when the statute was first enacted, until 1945, the only way criminal proceedings were commenced in Wisconsin was by going to a magistrate and having that magistrate issue the criminal complaint. From 1945 to 1969, I believe I have my history correct, either a magistrate or a district attorney could issue a criminal charge. From 1969 forward, district attorneys have been given the primary power to issue a criminal charge. That primary power is found in Section 968.02, subsection 1, which basically says that except as provided elsewhere in that statute, in sub 3, a person charging a complaint charging a person with an offense can be issued only by the district attorney. In sub 3, it says if the district attorney refuses or is otherwise unavailable to issue a complaint, then you can go to the judge and have this hearing. That's in 968.02 sub 3. The John Doe statute, however, doesn't have this precondition to coming to court. You don't have to go to the district attorney first. There is a case pending in which Chief Judge Brennan in Milwaukee has taken the position that as a matter of common law exhaustion, she would require, and in that case required a person to go to the district attorney before starting the John Doe, but it isn't required by the statute. So, a person can go directly to court under the John Doe.
I'm going to follow up with a question on the statute. In page 17 of your brief, you say, that, in essence, that the judge shall subpoena a witness requested by the state and may subpoena witnesses requested by the complainant. Where in 968.26, what words in that statute are you reading to support the premise that that statute says that a judge may subpoena witnesses requested by the complainant?
I think I know exactly what you're asking, Your Honor. And what I'm relying on is the language that says, and this is probably the entirety that gives rise to the crux of this case, perhaps, on construction. The judge shall examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her, and may, and at the request of the district attorney, shall subpoena and examine other witnesses to ascertain whether a crime has been committed. That's the language that I'm referring to.
Well, when I read that, I see that with regard to the district attorney, the judge shall examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her, and may, and at the request of the district attorney, shall subpoena and examine other witnesses. So I see, as I read it, the subpoena language in that statute in essence modifying the judge's response to the district attorney. May, and at the request of the district attorney, shall subpoena and examine other witnesses.
Right. You could read the statute, I think, and playing devil's advocate here, if I were representing HIP, I would argue that the judge shall examine the complainant under oath and any witnesses produced by him or her, and that's one clause.
That's right, which is before the and, which that's a clause, okay.
Right. And then may, and at the request of the district attorney, shall examine other witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That, I think, is a problem for me with the language of the statute. What I would try to persuade you of is that it doesn't make sense in terms of why we're here today to talk about subpoenas for the judge to be responsible for issuing subpoenas only for other witnesses, but that to enable the complainant to produce his or her witnesses, there's an option to have the judge do it or to have the clerk of court do it. But I would suggest to you that to have consistency over the whole statute, and for reasons which I don't think I've quite fully answered Justice Crook's question yet, it's beneficial to have the judge be responsible for issuing subpoenas for the entirety of the John Doe proceeding.
Well, if I could follow up Justice Bradley's question, and maybe I'm missing something, but as I see the statute, what it seems to imply fairly clearly is that when dealing with the parties, the potential parties to the John Doe, the district attorney, if the district attorney wants to subpoena witnesses, the judge shall. The language shall examine witnesses produced by him or her. That seems to suggest that the complainant has subpoena powers. The complainant has subpoena powers. And that the may language, may subpoena, that follows would be attended to any additional witnesses that the judge thought might be necessary after hearing the complainant's witnesses and after hearing the district attorney's witnesses. Now, am I missing something? Because when I look at that statute, that seems to be the only reasonable construction I can come up with.
No, and I don't disagree with the construction that you've come up with. I don't believe that a complainant can issue subpoenas, even by counsel, for a John Doe. The reason that we're here is because the circuit judge misunderstood what his responsibilities were in this case. And there's no question, at this point in the litigation at least, that the John Doe complainant can subpoena witnesses. The question is, who does the John Doe complainant go to get those subpoenas, the clerk or the judge? I'm here to tell you that it should be the judge. The Court of Appeals decided it could be the clerk or the judge.
Counsel, if I may ask you a question. When you look at the specific statute here that controls, and that's the John Doe statute, right?
Yes.
It says, as I read it, the judge shall examine, and then it talks about the people who come to court, the people who are produced, either
right,
voluntarily or by subpoena, the production of a person, then that person can be examined, right? Then the word produce and the word subpoena are different. If they were to be used interchangeably, then we wouldn't need two different terms within the same sentence of the same statute, right?
It's a plausible reading of the statute that produce means only those persons that the John Doe complainant can persuade to come voluntarily.
Okay. Then, well, someone who's produced in court, either by subpoena or voluntarily, can be examined.
Correct.
Right? But then there's the conjunctive term and this is talking about what the judge does. The judge shall examine the complainant under oath and witnesses produced. And then it says and, presumably, meaning the judge may, and then it's at the request of the district attorney, it's a shall. But the judge may subpoena and examine other witnesses.
Correct.
So the judge, under this statute, seems to have the subpoena power, and that subpoena power is limited if the DA asks, the directive is shall, but otherwise the judge may subpoena and examine other witnesses.
That's right.
Okay.
The question is, may, under this language, the judge subpoena the witnesses causing the production of the witnesses in the first sentence?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that you can produce, as Justice Ziegler said, either by voluntary or by subpoena. And nobody questions that the John Doe complainant may produce witnesses by subpoena. The only question is, where do you get that subpoena?
Okay, no one questions that because it just makes so much sense,
right?
I mean, how can you have a system where only one side can compel witnesses to show up? I mean, it doesn't sound fair. There's a certain due process.
Well, there really aren't two sides here. There's really just one side.
But you're correct. But it's there's a certain sense of fair play to allow a complainant to be able to make his case
right,
and not have to rely on his just his friends who voluntarily show up. So in that sense, there's a fair play. But I say to you, I still am not convinced, although it makes all the sense in the world that there's subpoena power to compel witnesses on behalf of the complainant. Where do you find that in the statute? I'm still at a loss where the judge subpoenas, I can see the judge subpoenas other witnesses, but other to what? Other to the witnesses produced by the complainant.
Well, in that sense, the statute really is odd, because who are the other witnesses? It would be other people the judge could think of. But anyway, if you look at State Ex Parel Long back in 1889, they talked about what do you do with subpoenas. And the issue in the case, the crux issue in the case was, does this John Doe magistrate have subpoena power? Because the statute at that point didn't have this language about subpoenas. And the court said yes, that's necessary to be able to conduct the John Doe properly. And in the case, they said, well, how does the complainant get witnesses? He names the witnesses, tells the John Doe judge who he wants, and the John Doe judge subpoenas them. And that's the way it's been interpreted and applied consistently since 1889.
Let me challenge that. Because you have the case of In Re Wisconsin Family Counseling Services in 95 Wisconsin. That's a 1980 case, much more recent than State versus Long.
I'm familiar with the case, Your Honor.
Yeah, I know. And that case says, agrees with you in part. Certainly the judge, or the magistrate, I guess, but the judge here can subpoena. But where does the judge get the subpoena authority in a John Doe? And that case at page 675 says he gets it or she gets it under 885.01.
I know that.
So what do you do with that?
I think that's just a codification and a recognition of the inherent subpoena authority that the court recognized in Long. I don't do anything with it. I think that is the source of the judge's subpoena power.
Okay.
The question is, who should subpoena witnesses for a John Doe proceeding at the request of the complainant? Well, the whole difficulty with this case lies in its facts, but it shouldn't dictate what should happen in terms of the policy and the way the case should proceed forward or any other cases in the future.
What happened
in this case is Adrian Hipp reasonably said to Judge Murray at the very first hearing, how do I get witnesses to come who won't come voluntarily? To which Judge Murray said, in kind of a non sequitur, sir, I am not the judge in this case. I am just responding to the petition that you wrote. You have to bring in information to me. I'm just a police officer trying to do an investigation here. Well, had I been in the room at the time and could have pulled Judge Murray aside, I would have said, say to Mr. Hipp, tell us who you want to be your witnesses, and I'll subpoena them. Or if I elect not to subpoena, I'll have to explain why not.
Which raises the question, Mr. Rice, of I'm trying to ascertain exactly why the case is here. It would appear from what you're saying that you agree that the complainant had a right to compel the attendance of witnesses.
Absolutely.
And if you agree that the complainant had a right to compel the attendance of witnesses, and the only question is which person will produce the subpoenas, the clerk or the judge.
That's right.
What is the import then for this court to deal with this case?
Well,
it sounds like both parties agree that the complainant can compel the attendance of witnesses.
What happened was the clerk then, Hipp didn't, the judge didn't issue the subpoenas. Hipp gave him a list 2 days later. Judge still didn't issue the subpoenas. So then Hipp consulted with a lawyer, and the lawyer said, I assume the lawyer advised him because the lawyer's name was on the subpoenas, go to the clerk and get them. So he went to the clerk and he got the subpoenas. Then the subpoenas are served, and some of the people, including the John Doe complainant, go to the district attorney, and the district attorney says, don't go. You don't have to go because the clerk doesn't have authority to issue subpoenas.
And the Court of Appeals dealt with that in its opinion and remanded it so he could have the witnesses compelled to attend.
And I'm saying on remand that they ought to be ordered to attend by the judge, assuming that the complaint survives the six-year statute of limitations inquiry that, is, that whoever is assigned, Judge Murray's been rotated. I don't think he'll get this case.
So just so that I'm clear, your position is not to challenge the authority on remand to compel the attendance of witnesses. You're only questioning which authority, or which individual will issue the subpoenas. Is that correct?
That's right. My position has never been, even though the Court of Appeals mischaracterized it, my position has never been, unlike my client, that you can't get a subpoena.
Got it.
My only question is who issues the subpoena.
Mr. Rice, isn't there another question, though, that immediately comes up, and that's whether or not the judge, looking at the list requested by the complainant, has any discretion to say, yes, I'll subpoena this one, and no, I won't grant a subpoena as to this.
Yes. And I think that the judge does have that discretion, and I'm not here to argue the second issue today because there's another case that precisely raises that, which you've held the petition for review in abeyance. I would submit to you that the judge has that authority, and that's why, as a matter of policy, it makes sense for the John Doe judge, rather than some clerk of circuit court who doesn't know what's going on in the John Doe, to be responsible for issuing the subpoenas. If the clerk can issue 100 subpoenas for every prisoner in a cell block, then the judge is going to have to deal with motions to quash. All those people are going to have to appear. It's not an efficient way to operate John Doe's. The judge has a sense of what the case is about, has the John Doe petition. Presumably, at the point that you're going to hearing, has made a determination that it satisfies all the threshold reason to believe requirements and is in the best position to know which subpoena should be issued and which shouldn't be issued.
Would it be your position that we shouldn't answer that question in this case but wait for the other case?
Yes. And I think if you read my reply brief, I'm persuaded by Attorney Ball. I think she did an excellent job in her brief that this case, the facts of this case don't really give rise to that second question. I probably made a stretch when I included it in my petition for review, but it is an important issue to the circuit judges, and I'm here today representing them collectively and not just Judge Murray in their concerns about how the statute's administered. To try to answer the question you raised initially, Justice Crooks, is the concern, if you look at 150 Wisconsin 2nd, that case involving the John Doe in my brief, there's three concurring opinions. If you read Chief Justice Heffernan's opinion, I see my time's up, should I?
You may proceed. No, you can continue.
Oh, okay. In that case, Justice Heffernan voiced a concern about having John Doe complainants come to court and initiate these proceedings and have criminal charges be issued just on probable cause, instead of what Justice Heffernan said was we should have the DAs look at these matters first and cases should proceed only on prosecutive merit. What happened recently was a prison guard at Waupun, I think it was Waupun, it was in Dodge County, was charged criminally as a result of a John Doe, and Judge Bissonnette said, I can't make any credibility determinations, and I find at least plausible this allegation of assault by a guard, and so charges were brought. As a result, legislation was introduced in the last session restricting at least the rights of inmates with respect to John Doe cases. But I commend that those concurring opinions. On the other hand, Justice Day, in a very eloquent concurring opinion, talks about the needs of the John Doe victim to be able to come to court, and that's kind of question you raised, and there are these competing concerns, and I don't deny that. But my basic point is there's no question that you should be able to get a John Doe complainant should be able to subpoena witnesses within reason. You've even imposed requirements on district attorneys. Even a district attorney where the statute says the judge shall issue a subpoena must meet certain criteria that you set forth in your 272 Wisconsin 2nd decision on John Doe's, saying what a DA had to do.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Ball.
May it please the court. My name is Colleen Ball, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, Adrian Hipp. The Wisconsin legislature has provided for a citizen-initiated John Doe proceeding so that crime victims and persons who have reason to believe a crime has been committed can have direct access to the court system. Judge Murray's interpretation of 968-26 minimizes the role of the crime victim petitioner in the John Doe proceeding, and it changes the judge's role from that of a neutral, detached arbitrator to that of a chief investigator. Under Judge Murray's interpretation, as Mr. Rice explained, the judge would have exclusive authority to subpoena witnesses to testify about a crime. This interpretation would require the crime victim to simply suggest names to the judge, the crime victim being the one who probably has the most information about the crime. The John Doe judge then may refuse to subpoena those witnesses, and he may do so without giving any reason for refusing to hear their testimony. That's what happened in this case. Now, Mr.
Ms. Ball, let me ask you this, because I understand what happened in this case, but we also just heard from Mr. Rice here during oral argument. His position seems to be a little bit different, and he seems to recognize, Mr. Rice recognizes, that the complainant has the ability to compel the attendance of witnesses. And what Mr. Rice has said pretty much is that the only question is whether or not the clerk should have the authority to issue the subpoena in addition to the judge. Do you disagree with what you heard here today in oral argument from Mr. Rice?
Well, I disagree that only the judge can have the authority to issue the subpoenas. I think the clerk of court can too. And that reading of 968.26 is consistent with its plain language and its purpose. And the irony of Mr. Rice's position is that limiting the authority to subpoena issue subpoenas to the judge actually has the effect of allowing criminal conduct to go uninvestigated and eventually unprosecuted, whereas if you allow the citizen, the victim, to subpoena witnesses through the clerk of court, there's a better chance that allegations of criminal conduct will be investigated. And the record in this case really provides a good example of what I'm talking about here. This case shows why that victim or petitioner's role is so important. Here, from the very first proceeding, the district attorney obstructed the investigation of the crime. He did it in numerous ways, but really the most egregious example probably that we see here is when he directed witnesses to disregard court-issued subpoenas. He had no business doing that. And the problem, of course, is that Judge Murray followed the district attorney's lead every step of the way, and when he did that, he abdicated his role as the neutral magistrate, and he short-circuited the investigation. Now, if this court were to rule that the crime victim or the petitioner can get subpoenas through the clerk of court, that would serve several purposes. One of them is...
Can I interrupt you at this point? Let's assume that it's only the judge who can issue the subpoenas. Do we get to the question of whether or not the judge has any discretion in regard to refusing to issue a subpoena to a particular name on the list of the complainant? Is that a question we should answer in this case?
Well, I think it's a very important question. I would guess that is probably one of the reasons that the court may have taken review, is the very point that you made during Mr. Rice's presentation, which was how can we leave the courtroom doors open and at the same time give the judge the discretion he needs to control what's going on at the John Doe hearing. And my response to that, Justice Crooks, is when you think about it, the judge has exactly the same discretion whether the clerk issues the subpoenas or whether the judge himself issues the subpoenas. He can control the extent of the examination, the order of the witnesses, whether to quash subpoenas or grant relief from them. At least three cases have been cited to this court, Washington, Wisconsin Family Council, and the 2005 unnamed defendant case. All of them arose, or at least proceeded to the Court of Appeals, based on a motion to quash. So, of course, the John Doe judge has that authority. He can also adjourn proceedings, and he can determine when the proceedings will be held in secret.
So let me give you a not really a hypothetical, but one that I want to be a hypothetical. Let's assume that you've got a prisoner up at the Green Bay Correctional Institution, and that prisoner decides that he's been abused, maybe by a guard, maybe by a social worker, maybe by a fellow prisoner. And he decides that he's going to have the court look at a list of 55 witnesses that he presents. So he goes to the Brown County Clerk of Court's office, and the clerk issues 55 subpoenas. Is it your position that even if it's the clerk issuing the subpoenas and not the judge, that now the judge can look at that and say, well, this is ridiculous, I'm only going to hear from 10 witnesses, and the judge exercises that discretion by quashing the subpoenas?
There are a number of options available to the judge. I can't tell from your hypothetical whether I'm to assume that the prisoner has filed a frivolous petition for a John Doe or one that passes the reason to believe test.
Let it pass the reason to believe test.
Okay. If it passes the reason to believe test, then there is authority on the books, Keys being one of them, that suggests that the complainant can produce as many witnesses as necessary to establish probable cause. But that doesn't mean that the judge loses all control over what happens in the proceeding. I think there's both legal and practical solutions to that problem, and some of them haven't been discussed in the briefs. One of them would be holding witnesses, for example, in contempt for perjury or other misconduct in the course of the proceeding. If 55 witnesses, I mean, he starts to take testimony and he realizes that somebody's lying or they're doing this just for a get-out-of-jail-free-for-a-day card, he's got the contempt power or his inherent powers as a judge to sanction them. But beyond that, I think there's a practical solution here to the prisoner problem, one that we really haven't talked about. Everybody agrees that the John Doe judge has a good deal of authority, discretion, as to what goes on inside the proceeding itself. Why not examine, in the case of a prisoner John Doe, why not examine the witnesses by telephone? Do they really have to be subpoenaed and hauled into court? They could be examined by telephone or audiovisual equipment. That is a procedure specifically authorized by 968.031D, which is a judge taking examination in the issuance of a warrant. I think the judge does have the discretion in the middle of a hearing to determine whether or not witnesses are presenting cumulative evidence or irrelevant evidence. He has to have that ability. And so another possible solution here is to just take an offer of proof from some witnesses to try and figure out, well, who's really got the best evidence that I need to start with in this John Doe hearing.
Counselor, what about giving the judge the authority to initially limit the number of witnesses that can be subpoenaed? Say, you can bring in 10. You bring me your 10 best. And if, in fact, you think more than that after we've heard from the 10, then you have to show me why the 10 need to be supplemented. Can the judge issue such an order?
That would require some communication, of course, with the John Doe complainant. And that's all right to say, let's start with your best 10. I don't see a problem with that.
What if the judge thinks he's heard enough to know that they're not proceeding on anything here that's going to result in a complaint? Does he have then the discretion to say, even though the complainant wants to produce another 10, you've had your best 10 and there really wasn't anything in any of those 10?
Well, the case law says the judge has to proceed until he either finds probable cause or no probable cause. Mm-hmm. And so he starts with the witnesses, and he may find somehow in the middle of the first several witnesses' testimony that there's not probable cause, that some facts become apparent that make it that clear that the facts here don't give rise to the crime or the statute of limitations is at issue or things like that, and then he stops it. Once he has a ruling on probable cause, he doesn't take any more testimony.
Okay, so in your view, it would be lawful for a judge to issue an initial scheduling order when the John Doe complaint is filed and after he gets by the reasonable suspicion standard, so he's going to proceed further to say, you know, you can provide your best 10 witnesses, and that's all we're going to do for now. And then when he gets done with that, if he thinks that there needs to be more evidence and he hasn't found either enough facts to show him there isn't going to be probable cause, then he could just stop the process right there.
I don't think that that is consistent with Keys. That would be my one concern there, because if you read that case closely, it says that the complainant can keep producing witnesses. But I do think the John Doe judge has the discretion to start taking testimony and to determine how long that witness is going to testify, to take an offer of proof, and to cut off the testimony at some point.
Can I ask a couple of questions? Right from the beginning, if an individual submits something to the judge, does the judge have to hold a John Doe proceeding?
No. Well, the first tool, of course, available to the judge is the reason to believe screen. So that's the first thing. He reviews the petition on its face, and he decides on the petition whether there's reason to believe a crime has been committed. If there hasn't, there's no hearing at all. There's no examination of witnesses.
Okay, but suppose people have already been subpoenaed.
Well, I think first there has to be the reason to believe determination, and someone has to set it for a hearing. I don't think you can subpoena witnesses just by filing a John Doe petition. It has to pass that step first.
So the subpoenas don't come until after a hearing has been set by the judge?
That is how I would understand the procedure.
Now, do district attorneys have the power to subpoena people for hearings?
As a general matter, they do. For the John Doe statute, no. The John Doe statute is really specific as to the district attorney's power, and it says that the district attorney must request subpoenas from the judge. And 885.01 sub 2, that's the general subpoena statute.
So if the district attorney were to initiate a John Doe, the district attorney would have to go through the judge?
That's how I read the statute.
The district attorney has explicit statutory power, but you say that in the John Doe, the district attorney would have to go to the judge. Is that right?
That's how the statute is written, Your Honor.
Why then should a prisoner not have to go to the judge?
Well, the first thing to remember is that not all John Doe petitions are filed by prisoners. Some of them are by other kinds of crime victims. Prisoners are just a subset. And there is a difference between those two clauses, the complainant clause, which says that they may produce witnesses, and the district attorney clause. I think that a little review of the legislative history, which this court, of course, can look at to confirm a plain language interpretation of the statute, might help explain what was going on there. In the beginning, the John Doe provision was part of a bigger statute that had to do with the issuance of complaints and warrants generally. And then in 1949, the legislature separated out those general provisions on the issuance of complaints and warrants, and it made the 968-26 John Doe sort of a freestanding statute. Well, before it did that, the district attorney clause was not in the statute at all. That happened in 1949 when the statutes were separated out. And I think the clause, there's no case that says this, but it would seem that the clause was inserted into 968-26 at that time to give the district attorney a way to participate when the John Doe hearing is initiated by a citizen. And one reason that there may be a difference between the complainant clause and the district attorney clause is that it gives the judge the ability to control what the district attorney is doing. It would be improper for him to use the John Doe proceeding to conduct the sort of criminal discovery that he would need to establish a case against a defendant, which is what he would need to do once we're farther down the road, once the complaint has been issued and whatnot. And by putting that clause in there that makes the district attorney go through the judge, it would seem to be able to make sure that the proceeding was not improperly used for that purpose.
Counsel, can you help me out? Where does it say the DA has to go through the judge?
That is...
I know it says the judge shall issue the subpoenas the DA requests. At least that's what it seems to say.
That's the provision I'm relying on.
Okay, but that directs the judge's actions. Where does it direct the DA's actions to only go through the judge, if your theory
True. Going back again, originally the DA clause wasn't in there at all, and then it's inserted, and the only reference to the DA's ability to get subpoenas at the hearing is by requesting them from the judge. That's what that clause says, or what it's what it means, rather.
Well, it instructs what the judge does. The judge may subpoena other witnesses, or at the request of the DA, the judge shall subpoena witnesses. It removes the judge's discretion in the subpoenaing of witnesses. It seems to me that
the statute, if it directs the DA, then it also must be directing the complainant. I don't see where...
I guess I interpret the statute as having three clauses relating to the production of the witnesses, and I think that this is the plain language interpretation. One is that it says the witness that the complainant may produce witnesses.
Right.
And the word produce is broad, and it can include either the concept of bringing them voluntarily to the hearing or producing them via subpoena.
So you disagree that produce means in response to a subpoena. Someone's action, they are there, they are produced in response to a subpoena.
It could be that, or it could be bringing them voluntarily, either or. Produce is the broad term. Subpoena or voluntarily persuade are two subsets of the word produce. The second way that witnesses can come to this hearing is if the district attorney requests them from the judge. And if they do, then the judge has to subpoena them.
And why have and may in there? What does that language mean?
Where is the may language?
And may.
Yes.
Presumably it
right.
modifies subpoena because there's the...
What that means is that if the judge feels the need to examine witnesses beyond those produced by the complainant and beyond those requested by the district attorney, the judge himself has the authority to subpoena additional witnesses. So three different actors have a way to bring witnesses to the John Doe hearing.
And Ms. Ball, if I can follow up, because there's something that I'm not understanding the real dispute here any longer. Given your position that the John Doe first has got to get through a reason to believe test, and given Mr. Rice's concession, as I understand it here today in oral argument, that he accepts your three-prong test, that the complainant has the ability to compel the attendance of witnesses by way of subpoena at a John Doe. I mean, that's very clearly what Mr. Rice has suggested here today. As a pragmatic matter, then what difference does it make if the subpoena goes through the judge versus a clerk? Because it sounds like either way the complainant has the ability to compel the attendance of witnesses once they get beyond the reason to believe test.
I don't think that it does make a difference whether the complainant works through the clerk or the judge. I guess I understood Mr. Rice as arguing that the complainant must always go through the judge. And my argument is, if you look at both 968.26 and 885.01 sub 1, the complainant may subpoena witnesses using the clerk of court in end of story. It's the plain language of the statute.
I understand your point, but I guess from looking at Mr. Rice's position here today, on the merits of whether or not the complainant can bring witnesses to court by way of subpoena, he's not arguing that point with you. So the only question that he's arguing is whether or not the person who actually signs the subpoena has to be the judge himself or a clerk for the judge. Now, if the test is going to be the same either way, you still have to meet the reasonable belief standard either way, and if you get beyond that standard, the complainant has the right to compel the attendance of witnesses either way, then I'm not certain what the battle is about, whether or not it has to go through the judge versus go through a clerk, because it seems that the answer is going to be the same either way. You compel the attendance of witnesses.
Well, if the answer were the same either way, I would agree with you, but I think Mr. Rice wants the subpoenas to go through the judge in order to screen out certain subpoenas. For example, the 55 subpoenas to prison inmates. He wants the judge to be able to say, I'm just going to look at three of those and not even bother with looking at the other 52 of them. And that's how I understand his position. But if there were an interpretation adopted here that says that the complainant has the right to compel the attendance of witnesses through subpoenas and the judge has no discretion to deny them.
But if I understood your point, you seem to suggest that the judge could do that even if the clerk issued subpoenas. As I understood your position, it was that the judge could seriatim. We'll start with 10, and we'll see if we now have probable cause or an absence of probable cause. And if we get the question answered at 10, then we don't have to go beyond that. Isn't that what you just suggested a few moments ago?
He has control over what's going on in the John Doe proceeding. Here's what he can't do. He can't make these subpoena decisions up front in a vacuum. And that's my concern about the position that Judge Murray is advocating here. At the moment that he decides whether or not the petition meets the reason to believe standard, he actually has very little information. I mean, it is possible that a prisoner could be the victim of a crime. He may allege that there are 15 prisoners out there who are having sex with a DOC official. And if he got that petition and it made the reason to believe pass that test, the judge should subpoena all 15 of those witnesses, and he does have discretion over what order he's going to take them in and how much of that examination he'll take. But when he decides the petition, he may not even know who the perpetrator of the crime is. He has very little information. So if he receives a witness list from the district attorney and a witness list from the John Doe petitioner, he still lacks sufficient information at that point in time to decide exactly how to proceed. A witness list doesn't tell him who has relevant information, who has cumulative information, who might be immune from testifying or have privileged information. The only way that the John Doe judge is going to get that information is that either someone will file a motion to quash and make those arguments, and so he'll have to sit and think about it and decide, do I quash this or do I proceed with the witnesses? Or he's going to have to start taking witness testimony, sort of like an offer of proof to see who knows what and where he should start and what the order of the witness examination should be. So I did not mean to suggest, if I did, let me clarify, I did not mean to suggest that the John Doe judge could look, say, this petition passes the reason to believe test, and I see that there is a list here for 55 witnesses. I will take the first 10, just like that. He doesn't have enough information to do it at that stage. He needs to have more information about what those witnesses are going to testify about in order to decide what makes the most sense for the order of the examination.
Why can't that burden be put on the complainant? Do you realize the amount of time you're expecting a judge to go through 55 people, even if they're all just given an offer of proof?
Well, it could be. I mean, if the plaintiff was in a position to make an offer of proof for those 55 witnesses and to say, Judge,
I don't mean 55. I mean, I frankly think 55 is an absurd number.
Right.
Just absurd.
54.
Okay, 54. Still absurd. I mean, I think that, you know, you want to keep the courthouse doors open, but you have to do it based on some reasonable standards so both sides and both interests that are before us really are met. And I guess what I hear you saying is that it all should fall on the opposite side of the street, those people that may not want a particular person to proceed. And what I'm saying is if you come to court, most people that come to court have a certain burden put on them to organize their facts and their presentation to the court so that the court can efficiently try to meet their concerns. And I guess I don't see why there should be a concern with saying, give me your 10 best witnesses. I have difficulties understanding that.
Justice Rogensack, I would actually agree with you, provided that what happened before the judge did that was that he examined the complainant, for example, and had some sense of who the witnesses are, why they're important, and so that he can make a determination on how to proceed. The part where I have difficulty is in saying that in a vacuum, which is really how the John Doe judge is operating at the time he decides there's reason to believe, in a vacuum at a point when he would have no idea who the best witnesses are or who even all of the witnesses are, he can't decide right then, I see a witness list attached to this petition. There are 55 witnesses. I'm only going to allow the first 10.
The first 10 is different from having the complainant say, these are my 10 best. See, I'm trying to get you to focus on the obligation of the complainant.
Right.
And I just don't see any reason why there shouldn't be some burden on that person to proceed in a way that's somewhat efficient for the court.
I think they should proceed in a way that's efficient for the court. Now, we have to keep in mind that many of these complainants are pro se, and that would be true whether they're prisoners or whether they're just the average person.
Sure, I understand.
So in this case, personally, I think that Mr. Hipp was extremely careful in his petition, and he attached a witness list to it, and he gave a very detailed account of what happened here, but that may not always be the case. I also want to quickly...
Could I ask, on the people who are subpoenaed, do they get a fee of some kind when they show up?
I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head, Justice Prosser.
Well, if they did, who would pay that?
I don't know the answer to that either. I apologize.
Ms. Ball, I've got a different question. There's a question of mootness in regard to Mr. Hipp's case, tied into the statute of limitations for theft. How do we handle that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I guess I'd like to say that having that issue raised by the state, usually it's raised by the criminal defendant, but having it raised at this late date looks like another attempt in a long line of attempts in this case to prevent the John Doe investigation from going forward. But in any event, Mr. Rice has conceded in his reply brief that the record is insufficient to apply the statute of limitations to Leslie Coleman due to the fact that we don't know what her residence status has been for 6 years after the crime. There's also the question of whether equitable principles should apply here. And we know that there have been at least two communications between the district attorney and Leslie Coleman. What we don't know is, did she say something like, I really don't want to show up at the John Doe hearing. What can I do to get out of it? Can we push this past the statute of limitations? We don't know what the substance of the conversation was. And as a result, I think that a remand to address equitable principles would be in order here. But I also think there's a practical solution to the statute of limitations problem. I mean, this court has the ability to conduct a de novo review of these John Doe transcripts and decide whether or not probable cause was met. And I would suggest that you could do that. All of the transcripts are attached to the response brief, and you could determine that probable cause was met and direct that on remand a criminal complaint be issued and let Leslie Coleman raise the statute of limitations defense and let the process work out that way. But a third option, of course, would be to simply remand the case for evidentiary hearings on both statute of limitations issues. And also to remand it to allow Mr. Hipp to call the witnesses that he wanted to have testify.
Now, counsel, I want to know what's in issue. When we go back to the conference room to decide this case, in your brief you indicate that the issue that was raised, whether a John Doe judge must subpoena and examine every witness that the complainant requests, is neither presented nor preserved in this case. Some of the questions and some of the responses lead me to wonder if that's still your position.
I think the questions and the responses are trying to get at sort of the underlying concern of the whole case, like what is the judge's control over the John Doe proceeding? I think that the second issue technically is not presented. I mean,
is the only issue that is presented to us as this case has evolved the following? Does the judge have the exclusive right to issue subpoenas in John Doe? Is that it? Is that what we're fighting about? Is it only the judge who can issue, or is it the judge and anyone in 885?
I think that's the correct statement of the issue. I'd like to address a concern that Mr. Rice mentioned at the outset of his argument. He gave the court the impression that the court system's overwhelmed by John Doe petitions being filed by prisoners. And in preparation for the argument, I called the director of state courts and spoke with, I believe her name is Kathleen Murphy, and asked her, well, just how many John Doe petitions are filed system-wide in the state of Wisconsin in 2007? And she said 132 total for all counties. And that doesn't strike me as an alarming number. And I do appreciate the fact that whatever the court decides here, it will have implications for future cases. But I think that we have identified a number of controls or screens or tools that the judge can use in order to maintain control over the John Doe proceeding so as to screen out frivolous, if they are frivolous, John Doe petitions filed by pro se prisoners. I guess, unless there are any other questions, I'd like to pretty much just sum up. And that is, I think that Judge Murray's interpretation of 968-26 really makes it more difficult for crime victims to initiate meaningful investigations of criminal conduct. Some of the crime victims that come to our court system are pro se. Some of them are unsympathetic or controversial victims. Some of them are alleging crimes committed by the state or the district attorney. And 968-26 is there for all of those victims. It's there for all citizens of Wisconsin. And so it is very important to not throw the baby out with the bathwater when the court issues this decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Rice?
May it please the court. First, answer Justice Crook's questions about mootness. Perhaps none of us are blameless in this case, including myself, other than Ms. Ball, who's probably blameless. it didn't occur to me, quite frankly, that there was a mootness issue until I was preparing my initial brief in this case, and I thought it was important for me as an officer of the court to bring that to your attention, because I'm asking you to decide a public policy issue, and if it's moot, I should at least make you aware of that. You may decide that it's worth proceeding nonetheless. But it also requires that when you write your decision and you do your mandate, it should modify the decision of the Court of Appeals mandate in any case to say that the case should go back to whoever the trial judge would be to determine first the question of the statute of limitations before being compelled to proceed with a John Doe hearing, whether to issue subpoenas or to have the clerk issue subpoenas. The authority for that is in my reply brief. In Riemann, that's what you said is the way the cases are supposed to be handled, so I suggest you should be handled. To answer Justice Butler's question, I am taking a position different than my client. My client didn't do the appropriate thing in this case, but we're not talking about what he did as much as what should we do in remand in this case and what should we do in all other John Doe cases. Unfortunately, we have a history throughout almost 200 years of history, 150 years of history, where the John Doe judges run the hearing. There's never been a suggestion that a clerk of court could issue a subpoena. Why did that happen here? Because Judge Murray didn't do what he was supposed to do. And HIP, reasonably, faced with that inability to compel witnesses, went to the clerk of court. But that shouldn't be the way it should occur in the future. For all the reasons, all the questions you've raised here as to why the judge ought to be in charge of issuing the subpoenas.
And Mr. Rice, if I could, I just want to clarify exactly your position here. You're not disagreeing with a mandate to remand this to the Court of Appeals for the judge to issue the appropriate subpoenas. Your only point is you think it's the judge that should issue the subpoenas,
yes,
and not the clerk.
That's right. The mandate should say if the case survives the statute of limitations, then there should be a John Doe hearing, the complainant should be able to subpoena witnesses, and the judge should issue the subpoenas. Does he have to issue 55 subpoenas? I'd say no. And I'd say that we don't have any parade of horribles here. Victims aren't being deprived of any rights. They can request to subpoena witnesses. The judge makes the decision. And then in 272 was second, the John Doe case you had in that volume, you said that the judge has power to subpoena witnesses, and if the judge exceeds the authority, then there's a possibility of review by a supervisory writ for an erroneous exercise of discretion. So if the judge says, I'm going to subpoena 10 witnesses, but I'm not going to subpoena the rest of the witnesses, then the complainant can seek a supervisory writ and try to convince the Court of Appeals to compel the production of the other 45 witnesses. And we can litigate that. But there is a difference here, and the difference is that it really does mischief. And I cited on page 21 of my initial brief, decision of the Court of Appeals, and it wasn't a John Doe case, but the language is instructive. It says, we recognize that granting an inmate the unlimited opportunity to subpoena DOC staff and other inmates to testify at a hearing may invite mischief or result in the unnecessary expenditure of resources. And then it skip a sentence. The court may disallow the complainant the opportunity to compel the testimony of any witness if, in the exercise of the discretion, the court determines that the testimony of the witness would be irrelevant to the issues being litigated, cumulative, etc. The practical difference here, and I alluded to it in a footnote in my brief, if the clerk of court issues the subpoenas, then these people are going to have to come to court. Some of them may have to hire counsel, and the judge is going to have to rule and make decisions on motions to quash in any of these cases. In this case, too, there was an assistant district attorney subpoenaed. There was an investigator from the district attorney's office subpoenaed. Now, the district attorney shouldn't have told them not to come, but the district attorney could have gone to the judge and said, for instance, these two witnesses are not appropriately subpoenaed for whatever reason.
Mr. Rice, your position seems to be shifting a little bit, and I want to pin you down on it.
Right.
Because as I understood your argument during your argument in chief, you accepted the fact that a complaining witness had the right, not the opportunity, but the right to compel the attendance of witnesses. And if the complaining witness has the right to compel the attendance of witnesses, unless it falls short of the reason to believe standard, which both parties agree with, then I don't see where the trial court has the authority to exclude witnesses. It's one thing to control the testimony to say, well, we'll start with 10, we'll see where we end up, we'll see if we still have a reason to believe. It's another thing to say, no, I'm going to only allow 10 if you have a right to compel the attendance of witnesses.
My answer to your question would be that the right to subpoena, I'd say, first of all, the complainant does have a right to subpoena witnesses, like the right of any litigant in any civil litigation to subpoena witnesses. But the judge has authority to control who's going to testify and which subpoenas are going to be enforced and which subpoenas are not going to be enforced. And that's really what I'm saying. And I don't know that in a case a judge doesn't have additional inherent authority to say to a party, I'm not going to subpoena 100 witnesses.
But if I could follow up, and I just want to make sure that I understand your position clearly. Generally, under subpoena powers, the authority for the court to limit that influx of witnesses that should not be there comes under the power of the court to quash a subpoena.
Right.
Which is far different from what I did not think you were saying before, but what I think you were saying now, that no, as part of a screening process, I don't even have to get to the issue of quashing a subpoena. I, in my discretion, can decide whether to issue a subpoena. That's very different from what I heard you saying earlier.
Right.
And I just want to make sure I understand you correctly.
I don't dispute that there is a right to subpoena witnesses. I think that the law would sustain the judge's authority as an issuing officer who has the authority under 885.01 sub 1 to issue subpoenas to make some determination whether to issue the subpoena or not. If the right is unfettered, then that John Doe complainant can subpoena 1,000 witnesses through the clerk's office. They'll all have to come to trial. There'll have to be separate hearings on every motion to quash. And I'm saying that I think the judge has some authority, and this I may be wrong, but I think the judge has some authority up front, as Justice Rogensack suggested, to make a decision as to whether these people are going to be subpoenaed. If they're subpoenaed, they have to come to court.
One last question. Do you see the subpoena authority under the John Doe statute, including the authority to quash subpoenas or to limit subpoenas, as being any different than the subpoena authority under the general subpoena statutes?
No.
Thank you.
And without demeaning all of the intellectual effort that's gone forth here today, but for Judge Murray's actions in this case, we would have continued along the same historical path that we have for hundreds of years, and the clerk of court wouldn't have become an issue. It's only an issue because of the unique development of this case. Justice Prosser?
Witness fees for these people subpoenaed?
I'm guessing that that they're the responsibility of the state, but I don't know the answer to that.
You mean if any citizen files the John Doe and gets past the first hurdle and subpoenas are issued, the state pays for that?
Well, I mean, the alternative would be that the John Doe complainant would pay for persons, but it's not civil litigation. It's kind of a hybrid between civil and criminal litigation, and I don't believe that it's the practice to require the John Doe complainants to pay. I don't know the practice. I don't prosecute John Doe's myself. I only represent the judges in these unique circumstances.
Could it possibly be the county that
I meant? When I said the state, I meant the county. There's kind of county-state responsibility for court expenditures, probably the county ultimately.
Could I ask one last question? I thought you gave an answer that said, but for Judge Murray, we would never have examined this business of the clerk issuing subpoenas.
That's right.
Are you sort of representing to us that if we started going through files over the history of the state, clerks would never have issued subpoenas in these cases before?
Obviously, I couldn't undertake that kind of a survey, nor have I, but I would suggest to you that my prediction would be that would be the outcome. After this case was filed, we did do a survey in our office of district attorneys to find out what their practice was. And the practice is, universally among district attorneys in the state, is they go to the judge to get the subpoenas. Even though they have the authority under 885.01 sub 2 to issue subpoenas on their own generally, when it comes to John Doe's, they go to the judge. And in fact, in the case I cited earlier that you decided, 272 with second, you outlined the things that a district attorney has to do to convince the judge to issue a subpoena. I mean, in that case, you said the judge may not have to issue a subpoena if the district attorneys don't do, in their affidavits, the five or six precise things that you enunciated in that decision.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you, counsel. I would be remiss if I didn't say to the students, first of all, you heard two excellent oral arguments here today. Mr. Rice is here representing Judge Murray on behalf of the Attorney General's Office in the state of Wisconsin. And Ms. Ball is here representing the complainant, Mr. Hipp. And Ms. in order to get here, to prepare for these oral arguments, of course, it takes countless hours of reading and researching and marshaling those arguments and then writing the briefs. You had the opportunity to read some of the briefs, I believe. And then to prepare for these arguments and appear here today. And Mr. Hipp wasn't represented by an attorney, so the Supreme Court has a program, and we ask attorneys to volunteer to do all that work, which means nights and weekends and lots of preparation. And Ms. Ball, I would, as I said, be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that you are here today, I believe, as part of that pro bono program. And not only that, but she has been instrumental in putting together this statewide pro bono program, that is, attorneys who see their responsibility, as Mr. Rice indicated, as officers of the court, and to volunteer to represent folks who are not able to financially afford attorneys in appellate process. So I want to thank you for your service here today. I want to thank you also, Mr. Rice, for your service to the people of the state of Wisconsin, and both of you for your excellent presentations. Thank you. We're in recess until the next oral argument.